Stupid, eh? Are you a stupid fool? Well, why can't you drive then? You can't even drive! Bit great today, isn't it?
Well, hello everyone. I'm here. Welcome to another edition of The Deepest Lore. I have got a good mug of Nescafe Gold. And smooth it is too. I'm just having a look, a cursory look in the chat. Conway's Glider. What's the song called? You don't even know that yet, Conway's Glider. Can't even drive. Welcome, Pharaoh, back once again. How are you doing, son?
Yes, very good. Thank you very much.
If you're wondering, by the way, the song is called Spinning Toehold, and it is from All Japan Wrestling in the early 80s when Terry Funk and Dory Funk Jr. would come out to those tunes. And their special move, their finisher, was called the spinning toehold. Or as the Japanese commentators would put it, spinning toeholder! Spinning toehold! Anyway, Alexander Adams, welcome back to the Madhouse, sir. How are you doing?
Diversity is our strength, comrades. I'm doing fine. It's good to be back. Pulling double duty.
Yes, you guys were streaming late and now you're streaming early. Speaking of late and early, by the way, we may get Oliver Semiagog joining us later on, but I suspect he's currently sleeping his golden elvish locks. Now, today, we are talking about how to spot an astroturfed protest. And I suppose we should define our terms here. Especially astroturfed. Somebody on Twitter just before we came on air said, astroturfed, golly, where did you learn that word? And in fact, I've just seen a bit of news that Extinction Rebellion have been fined £2,650 after costing taxpayer money nearly £30,000. So that's an interesting outcome, isn't it? I mean, can you imagine... I don't know, unwashed and his anti-lockdown, anti-vax friends would get fined if they cost nearly £30,000 in damages, or I don't know.
I was going to say that Piers Morgan was charged £15,000, wasn't he, for that illegal protest?
There we go.
Already five times as much there.
Yes, and funny enough, I've been working all night on Carl Schmidt, and I've almost got my Carl Schmidt lecture finished. Foundations of Politics will be ready soonish. I'm hoping to get there before Christmas, and at this rate I may just make it. I think Schmidt is highly relevant here because he talks about the friend enemy distinction and about how the idea of the neutral state, the idea that the state could ever be neutral, is a liberal myth, basically. And that because the political presupposes the state, because politics comes before any state and is actually independent of the state, i.e. politics can break out anywhere, you know, the state can never be neutral vis-a-vis politics, and if it does pretend to be neutral, it will find itself, like the Weimar Republic, quickly swallowed by a power that is not neutral. Part of this non-neutrality of the state is the fact that it must define its friends and its enemies. And I have a suspicion that the reason that Piers Corbyn got a £15,000 fine and Extinction Rebellion got only that paltry sum is because Extinction Rebellion are friends of the state, while Piers Corbyn is an enemy of the state, quite literally.
Yeah, so I should correct it. It was only £10,000, but it's still three times as much. And he didn't cause any problems. I just sent a little link in chat if you want to.
I mean, did he cause any damage?
No, not at all.
They actually caused criminal damage, these people.
Yeah, no, exactly. And also, you know, personal injury. People were literally, you know, are very upset by a lot of the Extinction Rebellion protests. But I think in my mind, there's sort of different levels here. And I think keeping Schmidt in our heads the entire time is very important because, you know, if you think today, if you want to organise a protest, it has to literally be, you know, go through specific channels. So already you have to think any protest that is out there has to have at least some tacit government approval or it would be shut down, if that makes sense. So it's interesting to see how some of those kind of filters and layers have been put in place to, create the kind of allowable opposition versus the non-allowable, let's just say.
Yes. We're actually suggesting something even further with astroturfing, aren't we? That an element, it's not just that this is allowable opinion and pushing it an open door, but there are active, let's just say, elite forces, forces within the establishment, actively helping this along, possibly even providing resources. Probably the most famous example of behind-the-scenes astroturfing we ever saw was when Greta Thunberg accidentally released that internal message.
Telling her when to text certain things and what to say. Yeah.
Yes, and I believe it happened with some celebrity as well. And that was also Extinction Rebellion. Alexander Adams, anything you'd like to add about the nature of astroturfing and what we're looking out for here?
So what we're looking out for is support not just from government figures, but from elite figures. So these are sources of money, sources of influence, NGOs. In researching my book, my forthcoming book, Artivism, I looked at the way that I had two case studies. One is Extinction Rebellion, and I have a paragraph to read from the book, which is going to be relevant because that's about the funding of Extinction Rebellion. The other case study was the way that the Arab Spring was not, I wouldn't say it was entirely astroturf, but it was certainly encouraged, financed and organized by NGOs, which also received US federal funding. So some of that was going into the Arab Spring. And that's actually admitted in this book, which is RORI, which is, I think that's how it's spelled. It's RUARIDH, Arrow. And his book is Gene Sharp, How to Start a Revolution, Big Indie Books 2020. And we're going to be looking at an extract of that. But in that, there was actually a whole chapter on the way NGOs and charities and different foreign organizations, not Arab organizations, based in Europe, were funding and supporting and training activists who were busy in the Arab Spring. And it's completely out in the open.
Can I just riff off that one second? And I think in my mind, astroturfing itself, yes, there's the physical protest, but as part of that, you need to have specific people in place. You need to have resources to support your protest. You need to have got the marketing to generate the people to join the protest. So there's kind of like different angles and different layers to the astroturfing. You can take an organic protest and then astroturf it. You know, like maybe that originally there was a genuine seed of organic truth to something like Extinction Rebellion, but that was soon overtaken and superseded where obviously groomed leaders were put in place, amplified, money was put into the right place, that, you know, they received quote unquote, you know, the training from the NGOs, etc. So they become steered and captured effectively.
Yeah, I would say that one of the major red flags that I have is if there is one of these kind of quote organic protests taking place and all of a sudden it's on the BBC front page, like now, you know. Because I really think that the what makes it obvious is the media coverage. I mean, I chose for the front page of this that picture of were they all like dressed as handmaids or whatever in the Extinction Rebellion, or whatever they're dressed, you know, Kabuki theater, whatever it was they were dressed as. Now that is a professional looking media shot. I mean, I don't know about cameras and things, but I'm guessing that was taken with like a proper kind of press camera, you know.
Yeah, I mean, these things are organized, they're coordinated, they're choreographed, they actually have people who are, maybe if they're not professional cameramen, they actually have professional equipment. There was one where they hired a drone to sort of fly over and get good images, and that's all uploaded as a sort of a short edited video on their own website.
Yeah, whereas when a protest does not have this kind of astroturf backing, you'll notice that the media often black it out, or they'll do their little tricks, like they'll actually counter signal it by trying to show how few people there are there. You know, you'll get the kind of weird overhead angle to show, like, I mean do you remember there was that whole nonsense about the size of Trump's crowds and all that sort of stuff?
Yeah.
You'll see all of that sort of thing come out, or, you know, the anti-lockdown guys will tell you they just won't cover it at all.
Yes, that's true.
Or the most obvious one is the Elevis, which I think went on for a year.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a year and a half it, like, before twice. Lockdown. Yeah.
So yes. There's one more thing I wanted to mention, which is that I've got quite a sought after book that came through the post, which has actually just been banned from Amazon and all sorts of places, called The Transgender Industrial Complex by Scott Howard. I've put it in my nice, lovely new glass bookcase. Give me a second, I'll go and grab that and see if there's any tasty morsels in there, because that book is all about exposing who exactly has been pushing, you know, all of the trans stuff, and it basically shows that it's incredibly top-down, elite-driven, non-organic thing as well. So just give me one second, I will grab that book and then we'll get going on this. Hold on.
I should just add that I've got a copy of This Is Not a Drill, an extinction rebellion handbook, which was published by Penguin, so hardly raging against the machine there. Yeah. And I'll be able to read out a couple of extracts which will talk about the way they prepare.
Yeah,
and,
I mean, forbidden literature
events.
Carry on.
Oh, no, that was just to say I was going to read out a couple of paragraphs from the Extinction Rebellion handbook.
Yes, indeed. I've always wanted one of those barrister's bookcases, by the way, and now I've got one, so it's another dream fulfilled. Now I've made it in life, I've got a barrister's bookcase. all right, so how are we going to do this? Do you want to start with the images, or do you want to start with the list from Gene Sharp, or do you want to start with the bit from Extinction Rebellion book? Up to you, Alexander.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, it's maybe we'll go with the images first so that people don't get bored.
Okay, all right. Let's do that.
Not that I'm saying anything about your audience, of course. I mean, I'm one of your audience, so, you know.
Yes, but you know, as we've seen on this show in particular, many of the audiences are trucks, low-level trucks, so they're prone to boredom. They need to be shunted by tender engines on a constant basis. 13 significant protests that changed the course of history. This is from Live Science, Bugman Central.
I chose this because it was just a very cringe listicle article, but it was interesting how they'd sort of pulled it together, and they've got a nice selection of shots from the different different protests. So obviously, you know, the first one, obviously, George Floyd. Now, what's interesting for me is that these protests sort of ripped through not only the whole of the US, but internationally very, very quickly. And again, if you think about how ideas permeate, it's very hard to get, to transfer ideas across. You know, if you think about our kind of circles, for example, you'll be talking about something and then it'll be, you know, years before the mainstream conservatives pick up on those ideas.
Yeah.
Apart from custard creams.
custard cream element, yeah. And basket weaving, if you remember.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, yeah. But you have to ask the question, you know, how did this travel so quickly? And again, I think it would going through red flags. This is another red flag. Whenever you see a protest movement that has these kind of multiple start points or kind of multiple spark points, then you have to ask the question, you know, it's not organic when you've got so much like coordination at a local and then also more importantly global scale. You know, people in Japan were asking, why is there a Japanese BLM movement going on in a country that, you know, barely has any black people, where they're police violent, you know, the police are known. I mean they still have capital punishment. So in some ways you could say they are violent, but you know, the Japanese police are very good. So why is this a global phenomenon?
Now looking at this image, there are a number of elements that jump out to me. One of the things I would say is the postmodern nature of this fist thing. That's the like the international socialism fist, isn't it? The Solidarity Brothers fist, is it not?
And also Black Power, yeah.
And also the Black Power fist. So, like, when did that start? When was that a thing? And the second thing is that looking at it, to my untrained eye, I would say that lots of these signs look organic and, like, these people genuinely have been motivated to make them and go out. I would just say that these just are people who've been successfully psyoped rather than or they're true believers or something. The only sign that looks like fake to my eyes is this like printed out Black Lives Matter one, which is a logo.
Often like those kind of organizing groups will have PDFs or things that you can download. But again, this is what I'm talking about. There's different levels of astroturfing. I would say that this is a group of people who all came out, most of them came out like in an organic fashion, as in they were not bused to a specific place or given specific signs. However, you've got to think those trigger points were all manufactured. Why are they all doing the kind of same fist? I think that's a really good point. You know, this shared symbology that you'll see not just at this protest but across the globe as well. So it's those kind of things which make it more obvious to me that this was a inorganic, triggered, elite-driven thing.
Well, one of the things I remember that happened in my old job, Pharaoh, is that in the common room, they put some art right on the wall. I don't know who decided this or who did it or who decided what went on it, right? Obviously, that person was sovereign, to come back to Schmidt, but they basically put like a kind of, you know, the canon of kind of Globo Homo heroes on the wall. And then the solidarity fist like that with like a rainbow on it, you know, and around the fist was like a kind of feminism symbol as well. I'm trying to remember who was on there, you know. Weirdly, John Stuart Mill was on there, which kind of caused me to raise a slight eyebrow, but then I thought, actually, that's kind of accurate as well. But then all the others are kind of like your usual suspects, you know.
I would say something about the signs here. I remember that when there was some trial, what's it, the Chauvin trial, didn't they? They had the BLM or Antifa had these vans, and they brought up the vans, and the vans already had like sort of dozens and dozens of signs, and they had the dustbin lid, the garbage lid, shields that they were going to sort of hand out to protesters. So what they were doing was organizing. They had this material already done, and that it had been made in some sort of garage or warehouse or stuff, and it was bussed in. So even if the people are not bussed in, a lot of the signs and the weapons, because some of the placards have sticks and they can be used as weapons, they're brought in by organizing committees.
Yeah, I remember when I was making The Ashes of Civilization, I did an episode on Georgia, and there was in Georgia where there was like the last white only town in America or something ridiculous like that, with an area that was like avowedly kind of, you know, white and racist and hicky and kind of rednecky. This was like big news in 1987, I think. Oprah Winfrey did a thing on it. All the different news channels did a thing on it. And essentially what they did is they sent people from all around the country on buses to this small town, basically saying, like, why aren't black people living here? Is this Jim Crow, etc.? And then, like, filming, like, causing trouble and then filming that and beaming it, you know, beaming it across the media. So the busing,
There was the famous black activist whose name I can't remember. He died recently, and he wrote the book Beautiful Trouble, and that was basically you get in people's faces again and again and again, and you push and push. And as soon as they push back, you play the victim, and you say, well, they've resorted to violence. That's the photograph that gets published when the people push back for the first time.
And in fact, I might talk about this tomorrow night on Unpopular Opinions, because I think I've spotted a bit of the right engaging in this sort of activity, or the establishment right anyway. And that is Rod Liddell at the Durham University, I believe, has basically engaged in those tactics. Maybe he learned it back in his like radical days or something. But it's clearly a manufactured clickbait outrage. I mean, of course, if Rod Liddell turns up at Durham University, he's going to cause some, you know, and he's going to trigger the snowflakes, etc. And therefore, you've got a ready-made story that can go all around the anti-woke sphere, you know.
Mm. Yeah.
Just another, going back to kind of red flags and BLM, one thing that you flagged up before, AA, is about when do these occur? When do they get publicised? And again, as soon as Trump left office, the tap was shut off. And again, if you saw kind of like at the last election, there was this huge spike in protests going on as well. So again, that's another interesting thing for me. Compare it to someone like the Yellow Vests, who just went out constantly, like you said, for an entire year, or some of the anti-jab movements as well. Mm-hmm. They've just been going out day after day after day, or week after week after week. And even if the people, even if there's not a huge number of people, they've had that consistency, and I think that organic nature. While this feels like it was switched on and then it was switched off, and that's part of the you need to have the control over these moments and movements as well.
So let us have a look at the next one, Dan. So this is the March for Science. What was this then? What was the March for Science?
See, I'd never heard of this before, but again, I thought just in terms of like a true AstroTurf protest. I seem to remember
Thunderfoot may have been involved with this, or people really? Like Thunderfoot went on the one. So I seem to remember somebody went on the March for Science. Maybe just King Crocoduck, I can't remember. Yeah.
But look at the quality of posters, though. All pre-printed, all cut out. Like, again, it's actually quite hard to do, to make one of those glass flask. and they've obviously had, like, a good quality designer. And also the designer looks like he's done the same as the banner as well.
Can you see who's there, Vera? Bill Nye, the science guy.
Is that actually Bill Nye there, is it?
Yeah, right in the middle. Who is basically the US mainstream media avatar of science, or one of their like three avatars of science. Neil deGrasse Tyson is another one, and I can't remember who else would be. I mean, on British TV, the equivalent figure is probably like David Attenborough. And,
Who's the guy, the astrophysics guy?
Hawking. Oh yes, Brian Cox. Oh, yes.
Yes.
Brian Cox, yes. Yeah, sorry. And maybe I don't know if he's around these days, but there's also Robert Winston. You know, these are just kind of faces that you associate with science on television. Maybe even Dawkins, although his mainstream profile is not as big as it used to be. I mean, to give you an idea of the profile of Bill Nye, the science guy, I remember going to like Universal Studios in Orlando, and like on the science ride, like he was there. You know, he was the on the videos. You know, so you know he's been a. I think he's at the front and center of many of these campaigns these days.
I think that getting big names is a key policy of these organizers, is they want to get the big names. They want to get the trusted names. Now, you'll see actually the reverse also happens when David Bellamy, who is a famous television biologist and zoologist, and he used to present lots of TV programs in Britain. When David Bellamy came out strongly against alternative power sources and against wind turbines, he was effectively cancelled. He was not given any more work by the BBC. He was kind of basically suppressed for the last 10 or 15 years of his life.
Yeah, and he was huge when I was a kid. Probably second only to Attenborough in the kind of whole nature thing, because he was on a lot of kid shows, you know, doing the nature thing. Bernays talks about this, by the way, in propaganda and elsewhere, about the importance of the authority endorsement. And if you remember Farrell on Foundations of Rhetoric, this was one of the massive nodes, wasn't it? One of the six nodes of persuasion was authority.
Yes.
And I think that, as we've seen in the past 2 years, people are highly prone, soft to this manipulation technique, to the extent where I believe they've done various kind of experiments in universities where, you know, you stick someone in a lab coat and you can get people to do some pretty horrendous things. Just by telling them what to do, and people
And that's also how authoritarian regimes work as well, because you give permission for people to be cruel. It's the same with wars of religion or tribal wars. It's once you have been given permission to be cruel, to be ruthless, to kill, to torture, to steal, then you do it, because you say, well, I've been given authority.
Yeah, no, I mean, we've seen that during the pandemic, haven't we?
Yeah.
Some of the rhetoric against, quote, anti-vaxxers has been horrific. You know, people literally just saying, I hope you die, you know.
Even to the nurses that they were kind of, you know, clapping for, but mere months ago. It's interesting. Can I just go back to Bill Nighy a second? Because, again, I think he is a perfect example of, you know, we talked about literally last week about the faces, and, again, having that the pantheon of figures that you can lean upon. Now, is Bill Nighy really, like, that science-y? It's sort of similar idea to Brian Cox. You know, is he like carrying out scientific research on a regular basis? Is he an expert in the in a specific field? Is he a tenured professor? You know, is he actually engaged in the process of scientific discovery? And the answer is no. He is a celebrity with a scientific background that has been positioned. He has been.
I think he came through engineering, didn't he? Or something, that was his degree.
Yeah, there you go, exactly. And again, there's. Our engineers, scientists, again, very. There's a good argument to say that's not even true.
He moved. Hold on a second. I'm on his Wikipedia page, right? Where let me just show you this. Young Bill Nighy looks quite a lot like Scott Bakula of Quantum Leap fame. Let me just show you this. Look. Oh boy, that's Sam Beckett of Quantum Leap. Anyway, I'm on this page here. Right, so that's him in 1973, okay? He graduated from Cornell. He worked as an engineer for the Boeing Corporation near Seattle. At Boeing, he invented a hydraulic resonance suppressor tube used on Boeing 747 airplanes. He applied 4 times unsuccessfully for NASA's astronaut training program. Then he embarked on a career as a stand-up comic after winning a lookalike contest for Steve Martin in 1978. I can see that. You know, it's a bit like Steve Martin. So that's it. He graduated, worked for Boeing briefly, came up with this hydraulic thing, then became a comedian, and then somehow became Bill Nighy the Science Guy. So,
but again, there's many potential. Many such cases of this. Again, Brian Cox, he whatever did a physics PhD, and, but then became basically a celebrity as the bassist of, was it D-Ream or something like that? I can't remember.
Brian Cox already was famous for being, weren't they literally the band who did Things Can Only Get Better,
which was the theme song
for the Dark Lord
himself.
Oh, yeah. My goodness. Hand chosen. But so many examples of this. If you go see who the BBC chooses, for example, for history, it's increasingly become like this. I mean, at least with Starkey and Sharma, you know, they've got a very strong background and heritage. But certainly on the history program, there was this Gingerbird who had like a background in osteology, ended up presenting all of these
Alice Roberts, yeah.
Yeah. All of these archaeology programs. And again, these aren't experts. These are just faces that have been groomed to represent. They've almost become like icons or something like that for elites to use.
I've just been reminded of another kind of semi-David Bellamy case as well, which was Patrick Moore, of course, who did The Sky at Night for many, many years.
And yeah.
Some people remember him as Games Master. I seem to recall that he had a few kind of controversial conservative views and was, towards the end of his life, you know, de-emphasized, and I think they should.
Yeah, I think he was very anti-EU. He was, but he had some bad experiences with Germans during the war, which was kind of understandable. And he wasn't really prepared to bury the hatchet.
So there we go. Let us have a look now at the Women's March on Washington. And it's funny, this was 2017. They were all like during the Trump era. So many of these are very recent. They changed the world. let us have a look at... Now, these are being advertised as protests that's changed the world. I was expecting to see Gandhi or something. But no, the Women's March.
How did it change the world?
Resist, rise up, woman. God hates Trump. Interesting.
Again, the signs of this are definitely organic, but there's interesting things like the use of the hat, the pink hat, as like the
pussy hat. Yes.
And what they did was they distributed the knitting pattern online, so people could knit their own.
I see. So,
just like where did it come from? Like, what are the reasons why that's originated? Was it focused around a specific person, or
the pussy comment, wasn't it? Grabbing by the pussy, that was what it came from,
right? But then, like, why hasn't it stopped though? Trump's still around.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, it was just kind of coincided as a annual thing they did just during his reign, which again, much like BLM, was transported around the world. Because they did that in London several times as well, I seem to remember, the Women's
March. And then it fell apart because a lot of the leaders were found to be anti-Semitic.
I see. And probably TERFs, now that I think of it, right? They were probably anti-trans as well.
I don't know offhand.
Hold on a second. Look, protests garnered enormous international support. 600 marches planned in the US, 81 other countries on the same day. Experts estimate that somewhere between 3.2 million and 5.2 million people participated in the marches in the US alone, easily making the Women's March the largest single day protest in US history. So there we go. And that was the day after Trump was inaugurated. So, you know, changed the world, folks.
And this was also, you've got to remember that this was a kind of an echo of the Me Too movement, which had swept Hollywood in 2016. So this was basically seen as an extension of that into politics as well. And then you had the Kavanaugh hearing as well, which came a little bit later.
Oh, man, lest I forget the Kavanaugh hearing. Mm. Okay. Then, I mean, even that was a kind of media curated kind of bit of high drama to watch on television, almost like you'd watch a drama. Just with a real person involved. The Protestant Reformation.
Told you. It's such a cursed listicle.
That's such a short text. Look at the size of that text. It's nothing.
Are we saying like Martin Luther was astroturfed? Turnip is going crazy somewhere.
Can you scroll up a second? I saw a bug reference. Oh, maybe it was just an advert on the side. Okay.
Oh, sorry. Oh, there we go.
How it body works. Bugs. Body bugs. I didn't know if that was a bug reference. Anyway.
AstroTurf by various kings.
But this did make me think about something like the Peasants' Revolt, where I think one sign of an organic movement is its violence, basically. So again, something like the Peasants' Revolt. It did have these kind of focal points. Is it literally like John Smith, wasn't it? The John Ball. He's the guy who read the. Come on, AA.
John
anyway.
Ball, isn't it?
No. Anyway. That was organized around a lawyer, basically. He, like, the middle class organized it, but the peasants were exceedingly violent. Crushing.
Yeah, there has to be a patron. There has to be a patron and a client, basically, any successful protest. And even when we look at the Protestant Reformation, which was obviously organic, right? It still required a certain degree of elite backing, let's just say. And it just so happens that Martin Luther's interests coalesced with, as I said, the interests of various kings and leaders across. Yeah. As against the Pope, So,
yes.
Then we've got the storming of the Bastille. What a ridiculous list. So we're putting the storming of the Bastille on the same level as the Women's March.
Below the Women's March,
yes. I mean, we can carry on, I think. I think the one thing to mention about the storming of the Bastille and the French Revolution is that the idea that it was just everyday Parisians is not true. I'm sure Apostolic Majesty has covered that in some depth somewhere, where, many of the rural peasantry were kind of with the aristocrats and against these guys. So, that was obviously not as straightforward as saying that, but in many parts of the country, they did not have popular support for the revolution.
And also you've got to remember that Bastille was a prison. So this was actually the place where revolutionaries would be taken if they were captured. So it was kind of tactically useful to remove a prison of the royalists.
Yeah. I wonder if busting out people who might help you out of prison is one of the tactics mentioned, because that's something that they've done as well a lot, especially in the BLM thing. One of the things that the Kenosha business and the with Carl Rittenhouse and the parade that took place and the guy who killed six people is that a network of people fronted by guys like Richard Branson, who I don't know why Richard Branson thinks is a good cause, and I'd like him to be accountable to someone and to answer for himself, but there's basically a tightly organized group that basically just pay the bail of various scumbags, like the guy. I mean, they literally, that guy
who ran over everyone the Christmas parade, they paid
his bail, and in some places they've even changed the law so that it's $0 bail. In the case of BLM, people were getting arrested, put in jail, let out the next day.
Supported by Kamala Harris during the BLM riots.
I mean, that,
the Minnesota Freedom Fund, I believe it was called.
Yeah, I mean, that is just really quite disturbing tactics, really. Anarcho-tyranny at its finest.
And one thing you find with terrorist groups is they're always, whenever they're kidnapping people, they're always trying to bargain their hostage for political prisoners.
So there's Gandhi.
I love this one just because I imagine that AA will be having a salt march at some point through the Tory boys' territory.
one thing I'll say about Gandhi is that he was not without elite support as well, with certain elements within the British Empire, I would say, which is something I did not realize until I started looking at these things.
Was it, is, it's a, Sorry. Yeah. I think it's really interesting because, again, Gandhi's vision was always for a united India. So actually, I feel like he was someone that, again, was part of an organic protest movement, but then was basically used for the aims of certain elites, wasn't he, basically?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the idea of Indian independence was being kind of helped along as early as the 1910s by various people in the Raj and in Britain. Quite why maybe we can't talk about, but my understanding is that Gandhi didn't, how can I put this, the idea that he had like everybody behind him was not entirely true either. When he came to power, he was very much a kind of minority, a minority coalition that then had to quickly move to define what it meant to be Indian, for example. Mm. You can see him reading people like Mazzini and others on, like, you know, making the Indian national myth, because obviously India didn't really exist as a country, or as a nation in that way. Mm. It was just kind of a collection of disparate, you know, states that had been under British rule. So, and obviously that is a highly political process as well. But that's more about Gandhi finding a political formula than anything else. You know, Boston Tea Party, South Africa's National Day of Protest. This was ANC in 1950. I don't know much about this.
I don't know. No.
The March on Washington in 1963. This was definitely an astroturfed movement.
Yeah, I was going to say
civil rights one. Pretty good book on that is Christopher Colwell's one, but also the C.A. Bond book has got what's it called, that book? I've got it here now. C.A. Bond goes into this as well. How much money was given to King, and the difference between the money and resources showered upon King versus the treatment of Malcolm X, who was, and you know, basically given the enemy of the state treatment, FBI surveillance, infiltrators in his movement, counterintelligence, all of those sorts of things happened to Malcolm X, who didn't really get a dime from anybody, versus King, who had the full machinery of the liberal machine behind him. Basically.
The press, the press, the money, the celebrities as well. Just going back, my thoughts with Bill Nye is that if you see a celebrity at the front, that's a big red flag as well. Like actually leading or involved in the top part. A lot of separate celebrities will just sort of bandwagon onto popular stuff, but when I think they're actually in charge of the leading, that's got to raise an eyebrow.
Yeah, Bob Dylan was there, of course, and you see all of these things create, to go back to the title of one of your books, they create iconography, don't they? They create postcard moments that give you an impression that history is created in this way, that if you want to change the world, all it's going to take is a massive protest in Washington in this way. But as we've seen with anti-lockdown, yellow vests, and various other protests that don't get anywhere, that is not really true. I mean, what are these doing? What is the purpose of this photo here? Do you think this protest actually pressured John F. Kennedy, right? Or did John F. Kennedy want civil rights legislation in the first place?
I think he did want it already. This is just sort of, this is just like something that he can use as an argument to sell to his more reluctant associates.
Yeah, I mean, I've mentioned this before, but there's a scene in Richard III, when Richard III, by Shakespeare, when Richard III, you know, he successfully kind of sidelined all his enemies, got the two princes in the tower, etc. And you know, there's a crisis in the kingdom, and they need a king. And you know, so he gets all these lackeys planted in the crowd. And he appears on the balcony reading a Bible, you know, and they basically say, you know, we need a king here. We need somebody to rule. Will you do it? And he's like, no, I'm a holy man. I must withdraw. I must attend to my studies. It's not for me. Oh, come on. You know, we want King Richard. And then he's like, eventually, you know, oh, all right, then I'll do it. But obviously, you know, it's an astroturf seed. You know, he wants to be. He's already planned. This is his entire plan to be the king.
I can just see the neo-reactionaries approaching you, and you're there reading your Evelyn and saying, "I'm just a simple scholar. I can't be your leader."
And in fact, hilariously, you know, I've been deep into Carl Schmitt stuff. Carl Schmitt exactly said that those exact words. It was his legal basis that was used to justify the rise of the Nazis, the legitimacy of the Nazis and of Adolf Hitler when they used emergency powers, right? And that's, you know, the exception. It's literally Schmitt was used to, because he was, you know, he wasn't just any old scholar. He was, you know, a legal authority within the Weimar Republic. And when he was approached about his complicity in this, he was like, "Oh, I'm just a legal scholar. I'm just nobody," you know, which is kind of interesting because he ended up with a regime that he'd been agitating for since 1922. You know, so very interesting to see. Although other views are available, there are lots of liberal scholars that try to quote denazify Schmitt, but I don't really buy it. I think that. But my take is that those are all just kind of because they were interested in the ideas and wanted to use them in the 70s and the 80s, you know, neocons mainly. Anyway, let's carry on. Tiananmen Square. I mean, there was a million people there, and the iconography of that is very famous.
Yes, in terms of changing anything, what did it change?
Nothing. Let's live power now.
Yeah, the question is: was it funded by the West? I think that's an interesting question. But I mean, I don't know enough about it. But I think
they built a statue. They built a small statue of imitating the Statue of Liberty, which of course is an American statue. So that obviously looks like. I mean, I know that they were just using it as a shorthand for democracy, but. Just make you wonder.
Yeah. The signs in English, that's the main question always. If the signs were in English, you know who the audience is. And then there was the Berlin Wall. Now, I have no reason to believe that the Berlin Wall process were astroturfed, but...
I actually lived in Berlin. I spoke to a lot of Berliners, and the Berlin Wall was much disliked. And people wanted to see it go. People had relatives on both sides. There was a very strong feeling that it should go. The fall of the GDR was sort of received ambiguously ambivalently by different people. But the wall itself, I don't think anyone wanted to see that remain, apart from people who had sort of vested interests in one side or the other. But I think the majority of the population did want to see it go. And that was
Here's the Iraq War. Now, the Iraq War protests are interesting because this is where the Corbyn crowd, Jeremy Corbyn, cut his teeth in these marches. I don't know. Was Piers Morgan part of that crowd as well? I mean, Piers Corbyn's basically a professional protester, isn't he? That's all he does.
Corbyn cut his teeth in supporting Palestinian groups and the IRA. He invited the IRA to the House of Commons in the 1980s, I believe.
So, these Iraq war protests are interesting because they didn't get anywhere, obviously. They failed to stop Blair and Bush. I remember it well. These are some of the biggest crowds in history. I remember, I mean, I've told the story before. I remember free sandwiches were being offered to go down to London for the day when I was in university. I knew lots of people who went. I did not go. Having read my Robert Kagan like a good boy, I was echoing neocon talking points in as a student. So, you know, thought I was being clever. I was wrong on that occasion. This did not get anywhere, but it clearly had highly organized backing. And I'm interested in because the remnants of the anti-war coalition, Corbyn's lot and, you know, the Palestinian ones and so on, they've done this so often that they're basically professional.
Well, but they later formed the Respect Party, which was basically a coalition between Marxists, feminists, old-style socialists, and Islamists. And that was the one that George Galloway stood for.
Now, I've got my Israeli buddies would say, yeah, what we're seeing there is, I mean, it's still astroturf, but it'll be, the money in there will be from like the Iranian government, you know, Hezbollah, whoever. And I happen to know from my dad's deep interest in Iranian politics, let's just say, that there are huge holes in the Iranian national budget, essentially, because their ruling class do almost nothing but fund these sorts of things. It's possible that astroturfing could come from another source other than, you know, NGOs, Western governments, etc., etc. I think it just so happens that there are significant elements within Globo Homo that are pro-Palestinian, which is something that is difficult to square in many ways, but it's definitely there, isn't it? BBC are pro-Palestinian, CNN are pro-Palestinian.
All the academics are pro-Palestinian.
All the academics are pro-Palestinian. Some of the reasons behind that are a little obscure. If you listen to Israeli nationals, it's because Israel is the final bulwark against Globo Homo, and you know we must ally with the Israelis or death. Basically, that's the message I get from Israeli nationals. Another take on it is that it's a permanent supply of anti-Semitism. So if you have a very loud pro-Palestinian voice, it also boosts in a strange way in the US establishment. It actually boosts the neocon. It actually boosts the neocons because, one, they can always cry anti-Semitism, and two, they can show show how in some way they've got the world against them, if that makes any sense. So,
and it also is actually recruiting agent for the Islamists. So I think it's like, there's one of the things that who's the document? Adam Curtis. He made a couple of documentaries about sort of the neocons and Islamists. And I don't agree with him on many points, but I do think that in some ways the neocons and the Islamists do have a vested interest in stirring up these sort of conflicts because it promotes both sides.
Yes, and this is why my father has frequently said that the best friends of the mullahs in Iran is literally like Benjamin Netanyahu, you know, like the Israeli government, and they help each other to such an extraordinary degree, because if their popularity is slipping within the country, within Iran, for example, that, you know, some shithead like Ahmadinejad can just get up there and say, spout some, like, you know, we want to blow Israel off the map type nonsense. And all of a sudden, you know, he can get more people on board with him, or he can garner some populist support for that sort of rhetoric, just the same as counter-jihad works here, you know, which I've talked about as well. I mean, Iranians are prone to, let's just say, it's a very conspiracy theory-laden country. Let's just say they see the hidden hand everywhere. A lot of people think that what's that guy's name? Soleimani. Do you remember when he was killed? That this was part of some deal, basically, because the timing was kind of perfect for their rulers, you know, to have something like this to show, you know, who the great Satan still was, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah. They just have a different friend-enemy distinction, and you can lean into that because the enemy is quite handy for rulers if enough people buy into it, you know, buy into the idea. The Orange Revolution, this is in Kiev. This is the protest, the results of the Ukrainian election. Now, this has got the sniff of NGOs, this one.
Yeah, this is a classic color revolution, isn't it? So.
Especially the American government is very keen to separate the Ukraine from the Russian influence, because of course Ukraine is kind of like the borderline. There are a lot of ethnic Russians living in Ukraine, and so there's kind of like a fault line. Although there are lots of blended families and so forth, there's a division between the Ukrainian nationalists and the Russian nationalists, and people in between who would like to have some kind of compromise. But obviously outside forces have a vested interest in moving Ukraine away from the influence of Russia.
Now, I'm interested in this one because this is one that I'm fairly certain had quite a bit of outside interference, as we were just talking about.
I think that's been documented, actually, hasn't it?
Yeah, and I know it. I mean, it definitely pissed off Putin because he still goes on about it. But look at the quality of some of these pictures yet again. You know, that one there. You know, I'm just talking about the postcard perfect. Kind of, if you were to... That's just the propaganda shot. How much does that evoke? Yeah, this is a great propaganda shot, you know.
Can we look at the flags a second? Can you just get a flag zoom in?
Look at that one. Putin, go home. EU flag.
EU flag.
I mean, that's organic, isn't it? You can see that's the voice of the Ukrainian working man right there. What are we looking at, Farrow?
All those flags. Can you see the orange ones across there? Because again, who is producing them? Who is designing the details on them?
Yes, who's giving them out? Indeed.
And again, it's almost like you can see there's other nations on there. So again, they're trying to appeal to European countries. Because again, I genuinely think that a lot of this is as much about generating support in European countries as it was in the Ukraine. Because, you know, say, for example, you had to go to war with Russia over it. You need to kind of think about the kind of defenseless Ukrainians versus... There you go. That's the shot there. That they've all got the same... Because it was all to do with like a party, wasn't it, as well?
Yeah.
I'm sure Prudentialist could fill you in on the geopolitics of the United Nations and NATO's involvement or their position.
Yeah, exactly. But these shots are for Europeans as much as they are for Ukrainians. So.
But it's also for internal consumption. I mean, it's also to show to everyone else who's watching TV in Ukraine, yes, we have a critical mass. Because if you can show that you've got a critical mass, you suddenly gain a certain legitimacy, not only in the eyes of people abroad, but in people at home. It's like, well, I'll back them because I've seen them on TV and there's at least, you know, 100,000 of them in the so-and-so square, which I've been to myself, and so I know the size and so forth. So that does count for something.
There was something that I heard. David Starkey has got his new YouTube channel, and I was listening to his talk on Bloody Mary, and he was talking about the kind of, like, why did her regime eventually fail? And his point was that, you know, she couldn't have children, and so there was this feeling that she wasn't the future anymore. And again, I do think a lot of these shots is to kind of show where the future is, where are your children's best interests in, and that's how you capture the mind of a country.
One of the sorry, I'm just laughing at some of these pictures. One of the nodes of persuasion, if you remember Pharaoh, was also social proof. And I think that goes, you know, so authority is one. That's the celebrity endorsement, Bill Nye, the science guy, or whatever. the other one is this, you know, social proof. As long as you can get, you know, if you've got strength in these sorts of numbers, maybe you might be encouraged to go out as well. You know,
someone in the chat said that the second language of Ukraine is England, so it sort of makes sense. But just imagine an English protest and then some signs were in French. You know, it doesn't, what's the point of a French sign? The point of an English sign is for an English audience.
Yeah, or for an international audience.
Yes,
or exactly. Or because you want to speak to the outside world. And you see this happen in many different places. You know, the left in America is always signaling to the rest of the world all the time as a pressure on, as a pressure for people internally. Look at what the rest of the world thinks. You know, every Republican president has been a disgrace in the eyes of the rest of the world, you know. Whereas Barack Obama, he's loved the world over. So is Joe Biden, in theory.
And I was just thinking about the American coverage of, you know, when the Trump balloon was up in London, all the American coverage of that.
Exactly. So there's a lot of cross-border signaling, especially when you, I mean, let's face it, a lot of these NGOs are globalists. You know,
they're all globalists.
Yeah, they're absolutely all globalists. So there we go. Anyway, that is it for that particular article. now you've picked up another interesting one, Pharaoh, which is Patriot Front, which a lot of people were accusing of being fed the other week. There was some controversy around it. We discussed it on UO, where opinions were divided. What do you think you found here?
Well, it was just interesting. I think a lot of the discussion around why it was legitimate was the fact that it's been around for a while and it's not this kind of like emergent phenomenon. There is you know, there are faces, etc. But I just quite like this is the SL PC website, and I think if you scroll down, they've got like a little stamp. There you go, on the left hand side. It's a designated hate group. So it's got the seal of approval here.
I hope they'll put that on my next book, actually.
Designated.
I'll have it as a pull quote on the front.
Again, I think this idea of just because something is old doesn't necessarily mean that it's not a Fed. And again, you've got to think about a lot of these things are kept on ice. BLM is activated, then it's quiet for a couple of years, and then it's reactivated. It is switched on and off and used. Now, again, I didn't listen to Keith's interview with the chap on the left there. But there are a few interesting moments that I felt made them stand out. If you scroll down to the end of private chat, and then could you bring up the last couple of there's like a Washingtonian article, and then a couple of Twitter ones. If you could bring those up,
yeah.
And I guess if you bring up the Washingtonian one, like I think the thing that again, a lot of people are tuned in now to the possibility of state actors or NGO actors, and again, you got to think about. From a reverse perspective, we've been talking about the shot, you know, the propaganda shot that's going to be in every single paper. Well, look at this. These guys have produced the perfect propaganda shot for a country which is targeting their citizens more so than ever. So in my mind, certainly in terms of timing, even if these guys are, even if these guys are organic, why all of a sudden are they starting to activate and kind of show themselves in this specific, you know, way, done in a very militaristic, you know, there's a symbology as well here, reminiscent of Charlottesville or, you know, various other protests, you know, the shields, the circular shield, the plastic shield, in my mind, immediately makes me think of some of those, you know, whatever, quote unquote, alt-right protesters holding shields and fighting with random people. But what my question is, why this time, you know, they look immaculate, perfectly grouped, all wearing the same flags, and it just happens to be at the time where, you know, the government needs a shot like this. They need a boogeyman to try and generate some energy, their Emmanuel Goldstein to shout at. So, yeah, that in my mind is very, very interesting. Now, could you bring up one of the other, some of those Twitter links just above this article a second? The thing that got me interested was actually how they arrived and then left the site. And I don't know if you can see here, this is basically, they all arrived in U-Haul trucks, which again is the hireable lorries, and then left in the trucks. And you can see this is here, the police shining a light in the kind of anti, this is like a random, they're trying to block the fact that they're being bundled into these trucks. And it's just like, is this really like an organic way to get to and from to a protest? You know, like literally the signs were being taken out the back of a U-Haul truck for the BLM protesters. Like, again, I'm just thinking if I was organizing a protest, it would be like everyone would, you know, go, I'd hire a minibus. I don't know, maybe that's a very English thing to say. But certainly not this kind of method of delivery that we've seen and, you know, Antifa used beforehand.
Yeah, okay. And then we've gotten one more.
Yeah, I think that's just another view from that little scene. There you go. Here's them doing a little announcement video in the truck. I haven't actually heard this. I don't know if you can share audio.
Yeah. If anything untoward is said, Susan, it's not me.
This is Luca Corgiot with Media to Rise, kicking off the live updates for today. We are currently in the back of a box truck. There is a caravan of box trucks heading to Washington, D.C., where Patriot Front is going to be marching, demonstrating, and giving some speeches from Thomas Rousseau.
Reclaim America! Reclaim America!
Okay, well, who's this guy then?
You can see the guy with the big hat. He sort of looks like a Confederate general. He's the leader on the SLPC, but I don't know. It doesn't pass my smell test, and I'm sure Keith is fuming right now somewhere, not on Twitter.
I mean, I suppose the question would be: is there ever organized action in this way that won't feel slightly contrived due to the tightly organized nature of it? Like, because it's always performative, isn't it? This is why I've always found like protests or like inherently a bit cringy. But you know, it's like, well, because you have to signal, right? I mean, I don't know if this is the time to turn to your list, Alexander. But there are quite a lot.
It might be good. Yeah.
Yeah. Let me just see if I can pull this up. Hold on.
Because this is a PDF of a document at the end of the book that I mentioned, which is Gene Sharp, How to Start a Revolution. Gene Sharp was the leader of an organization called Nonviolent Change or something. It's basically a way of organizing the overthrow of regimes without using violence. And so this is a list of, I don't think we need to go through these individually, but I think it's useful to go through this list because there's lots of things that we'll recognize here. Lots of things will be obvious, but a few things that might surprise people.
Right. What I'll do is I'll quickly read them and just say stop if you want to say anything, okay? Mm-hmm. Public speeches, letters of opposition or support, declarations or by organizations, institutions, signed public statements, declarations of indictment and intention, group or mass petitions, slogans, caricatures and symbols, banners, posters, display communications, leaflets, pamphlets, okay, stop. And books.
So I've got something here from the Extinction Rebellion Handbook. So this is published by Penguin. So this is backed by, big publishing. Not that I'm saying anything bad about that, because, it's useful information. So this is a handbook which is given to activists. And on page 120, 121, they have two paragraphs on organizing placards. So it says, the first paragraph, diversity of producers is vital. Everyone brings something to the look of the rebellion. Some are good with colours, some are more playful. The messaging may be precise, but we need variety so it doesn't look static or formulaic. Our style must be dynamic, pushing forward. We avoid aggressive colours, no obvious left-wing reds or conservative blues, no alienation or division. We are rebelling for a cause that affects us all, so we must be inclusive. So we must be actively inclusive. So they're talking here about Extinction Rebellion. Second paragraph. The anarchistic traditions of working with your hands and getting them dirty doesn't mean the outputs should be trashy. We'll hand paint banners and make sure they're as sharp as possible, thinking about how this might look in photographs, making the message clear, getting the font just right, but the odd drip looks really good. We need to embrace perfection in a world where everything is too shiny.
Okay. So they want, how can I put it? They're aware that they don't want to look too fake. So they need to have like a bit of like old fashioned protest grit in there as well. Absolutely, you know, maybe put some mud on the sign or something to make it look less.
Yeah. So this is being designed. This is being projected and promoted from the very top. They say they're telling people to do it like this. So they don't want everything printed out. They want some variety. They want a little bit of inconsistency. They want some imperfections, but they want it to be on message as well.
Yeah. I've got this bit from the trans gender industrial complex where he basically tracks the money for LGBT causes. He says over a 40-year period, 1970 to 2010, we learned that the top donors to LGBTQ causes by dollar amounts are as follows. Anonymous, 90 million. Arcus Foundation, 77.9 million. Gill Foundation, 66.3 million. Evelyn and Walter Haas Junior Fund, 46.6 million. The Ford Foundation, 46.1 million.
Ford
Foundation. Yeah. Oh, shit.
The Ford Foundation are everywhere, absolutely everywhere. HV Ameringen Foundation, 25.2. Pride Foundation, 22.5. Horizons Foundations, 22.7. Tides Foundation, 18.1. California Endowment, 16.3. That's some serious money pumped into just that one cause. ACLU also fully backed all of these, of course. Looking through this book, I'm starting to understand why it was banned from Amazon, because let's just say Scott Howard is familiar with the early life checker. Let us carry on.
But what's interesting to me about that is that there's loads of, when you look at the money, you don't recognize any of the names. Like, I was looking at the 10, who are the UK's 10 richest people, and I didn't know any of them at all, and how the money is very, very quiet. You know, it does lots of this, donating in the background that all adds up, but we don't know who they are at all.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is something I've been thinking about a lot when I've been writing on Schmidt, because, you know, he says sovereign is he, you know, who decides the exception. But who is that in America? You know, if I can't remember what I was listening to. I think it was the Joel Davis's Imperium cast. And they were talking about how if you were sat down, if you were a diplomat, and you sat down with Vladimir Putin, you at least know that he's in charge. Whatever else you make of him, you know that he is the dude making the decisions, right? Or the same with the top-ranking members of the CCP in China, right? You, it's not like you're going to sit down with Xi, agree something with you, but actually some outside actor really makes the decision. Whereas if you sat down with Joe Biden, is he making the decision? Is there any point to that meeting? Like,
well, he's not making any decisions at all. I think that's just because of, you know, what's going on in his brain. But yeah, I know what you mean.
But the point is, the president of the United States, in theory, the most powerful man in the world, we don't really think that he's, I mean, unless you guys disagree, I mean, I feel like he's not really making any decisions at all. And the same would go for Boris Johnson, right? I mean, does anybody really believe that Boris Johnson has had final say on, you know, the response to the pandemic? Or because I've had the distinct impression that it's been foisted upon him and that he's been uncomfortable with it. And that's probably why they're trying to get rid of him.
Do you remember when William Fence came to visit and there were all these protests?
No, I don't.
He came to visit Downing Street.
Yeah, he was literally like a couple of months ago.
Really? I missed that.
Yeah. No, I think you tweeted it out.
Oh, wow. I
well, you tweet out a lot of things, to be fair.
Yeah, I forgot that William Fence went to Downing Street. But the point is, this is a real issue for us because we don't know, right, who it is most of the time that is making these decisions and who is behind. You know, we haven't heard of most of those names. And yet, you know, these are possibly the people responsible for the fact that some of the members of my audience there are wearing skirts rather than trousers. You know, or, you know, possibly the reason why your daughter is now a man, you know. So, you know, these things have extremely far-reaching consequences. You know, this guy also goes into how the CIA backs many of these groups. The CIA are absolutely everywhere. But the question has to be then, well, why? Why are the, you know, who is it? Because I don't really believe that, you know, every member of the administration of Barack Obama, Donald Trump, and Joe Biden are 100% for all of these things, and yet they happen anyway. You know, the Tories have been in charge of this country since 2010. All of these things happen anyway. You know, so I mean, and this is one of the things where, you know, people say, "Oh, well, you're a man of theory, not a man of action. You're too black-pilled and all this sort of thing." But like, is your energy best spent harassing a politician who really is not the sovereign? Like, he's not the man with the, you know, he's not the person making the decisions. And sure. I don't know how to deal with that problem.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. It's very difficult to know, you know, removing a particular figure. It's just like, well, you know, if Boris Johnson went and, you know, Rishak, whatever his
name is, Sunak,
yeah, if he became prime minister, you know, there'd be absolutely no difference at all. It's just the same as like if a Hungarian financier died, you know, his son would be exactly the same.
I've taken to calling them. Globalist one, globalist two, globalist three, globalist four. What's the difference?
I think there's in my opinion, there is a slight difference. And again, I think Sunak or who's the other chap that's doing all the, I keep forgetting his name.
Javid.
Yeah, Javid particularly, again, are the real globalist creatures. I think with someone like Boris, he does have a few overriding things. Like he loves to be popular, and he, you know, you can tell from his love life, for example, that he likes to be loved and likes to have the attention put on him, and that's why I think he does a lot of the goofy things, because it gets press headlines. You know, that's why he wears the gnome hat. You know, the gnome hat with the police thing, did you see that recently? That's an obvious attempt to get column inches just purely for narcissistic purposes. And I think that he doesn't want to be unpopular. And again, I think that's genuinely why I think he is against the mandate. But I think someone like Rishi or Sunak would do it with a heartbeat, because they are, you know, creatures really forged.
But the thing is that he does it anyway. So, you know, whether he's doing it reluctantly or not, you know, it doesn't matter.
But he hasn't done it yet, though. Like, again, maybe he will do in the future. But again, I think so far he's held out. And again, you can only guess the pressure or whatever that's being placed on him to do it.
I do agree to an extent that he's got a worm tongue and he's possibly grit. Like, I've thought that Boris, ever since he mysteriously got ill, has almost been like Théod and King when he's like greyed out and he's got his, you know, when his eyes have gone. Mm-hmm. but the fact of the matter is, why has that happened? We elected him, so why is somebody else making the decisions? When it comes to Javid, my abiding memory is, do you remember when they did that leaders debate?
Yes.
And he said, hey, guys, should we all put in our hands and denounce Islamophobia together?
Exactly.
Do you remember that?
that's a friend enemy moment right there, again, instantly.
Shall I read out a paragraph about the backing of XR, Extinction Rebellion?
Yes, go on.
I can give you a paragraph from my forthcoming book called Artivism, published next year. So there's a paragraph about XR's funding. Like many revolutionary groups, XR receives the support of the elite class. In addition to crowdfunding, XR has received large donations from the Kennedys, the Gettys, billionaires, and charities. It publicly thanked a toiletries manufacturer for a donation. That was Lush Cosmetics. In 2018, a foundation with a history of backing, quote, radical and far left initiatives was created by German Greek philanthropist Antonis Schwarz, end quote. He made a substantial donation to Rising Up, which is one of the foundation organizations that preceded XR. This money was apparently used as startup capital for XR. £121,000 was donated to XR by the Children's Investment Fund Foundation, quotes, the world's largest philanthropy that focuses specifically on improving children's lives, end quote.
Wow. I have also found something here at the back of this book where there are a number of appendices. One of the appendices is kind of interesting. It's just a list of LGBT activist leaders, and it just lists them by name and title. I suspect that list is the reason why it's been delisted, this book, because they hate that. They hate lists, don't they? And I think that rules were brought in recently saying that in America, you're not allowed anymore to have target lists, what they call target. I mean, literally.
Yeah, and also Twitter has done that as well, haven't they?
Yeah, they're clamping down on this sort of thing, you know.
And YouTube, I think, as well.
Yeah, so you're not allowed. So, like, I mean, just, you know, Suzanne Goldberg of the Sexuality Agenda Clinic and Columbia Law School, Lewis Goldstein, Nate Goldstein, etc., Roberta Kaplan, Alan Cohen, etc. So you can kind of, I'm starting to understand why there was so much controversy around this book, because all of these people are basically in charge of all of these different pressure groups. But then there's a second appendix, Janet Weinberg, etc. There's a second appendix here, which says that after the Orlando attacks in the United States in June 2016, the President Hollande of France announced that the mandate of the Inter-Ministerial Delegation to Racism and Antisemitism would be extended to fight against LGBT-phobia, and that an action plan would be put in place. The plan is now launched. In order to implement the plan, an annual budget of 1.5 million euros has been allocated, which comprises support to LGBT organizations. A selection of most significant items in the plan are as follows. And then, right, so this is now the official plan of France, okay? Now, bear in mind that I bet you anything within France, you'll still see, quote, LGBT activists and protests, okay? He says, at the governmental level, national campaign against LGBT-phobia, network of officials in charge of the fight against LGBT-phobia in each ministry, same at the local level in each department. The public sector as an employer, ministries, public companies will have to apply for the diversity label, which is already inclusive of sexual orientation and gender identity. Interesting examples of existing support within the Ministry of Defense, blah, blah, blah. The use of first names of trans people, both as employers and users, will be facilitated in public services. Then, protect victims of hate crime. Communicate on an annual number of victims and on judicial proceedings. Test a procedure of the pre-complaint online. In all services in charge of taking care of victims, there should be one person allocated for LGBT issues. Putting in place campaigns against LGBT-phobia with focus on lesbian women in order to tackle double discrimination. Transmit systematically cases of LGBT-phobia on the internet to the prosecutor. And then within education, LGBT-phobia is to be included in civic education. Education ministry staff will be trained on the prevention of LGBT-phobia. And I mean, this list goes on and on and on. But to come back to Schmidt, one of his points is that the state is never neutral. The state is also never secular. The state always has a religion, right? And quite clearly here, this religion is being embedded into almost, I mean, it's got, you know, there's a body in charge of monitoring the media to look out for incidents of LGBT-phobia. Journalist students will be trained on LGBT issues. These are all backed by the French state now. In employment, partnerships with established companies, already doing well on diversity will be facilitated. There's compulsory training on discrimination for human resources staff in companies with more than 300 employees. In health issues, HIV prevention campaigns focus on STIs among lesbians. I looked at STI data among lesbians and it's basically zero. I mean, it's literally zero. Special attention to suicidal LGBT people, training of healthcare providers with a special focus on trans people. And it just goes LGBT refugees. Continue to raise awareness of officers in charge of examining asylum cases, supporting LGBT organizations active in the field. What I'm saying is that imagine now you're a charity or an NGO or one of these kind of groups that has already got millions of dollars of backing, and you're operating in France. You're not just pushing an open door; you're basically already an agent of the state. Do you see what I'm saying?
It's establishing the power of the client groups within the fabric of government. So it's giving them jobs, it's giving them power. And you know it's that formalized. All of this was already ready to go. It had already been proposed by these various pressure groups and lobby groups. And it just needed one atrocity to bump it up into being implemented.
Something that happened thousands of miles away.
Yeah, what you do is you take the outrage and you say, this must never happen again. And strangely enough, you've got a plan ready to go the next day. You know, we must never forget the victims of fill in atrocity X. And then you say, and because of that, we're going to be doing all this. We're going to be promoting this and promoting that. And of course, the politicians want to be seen to be doing something. And of course, they've got these ready-made plans coming from the lobbyists.
Here's my 52-page plan ready to go. Tomorrow. Of course, we saw a very clumsy attempt at that recently at the tragic death of that politician, if you remember.
Yes, that's right. So that was when the British Parliament suddenly decided that the way to prevent politicians from being murdered by individuals was to suppress online anonymity. Which I think failed, but I mean, they'll just try and push it through some other way.
So my question is, why has this book been banned? The one I'm reading from, why did I have to go onto like special websites to get hold of this information? You know, because it should be, to come back to the question of who is sovereign, this should be open information available to everybody, right? What I'm reading to you here, these are the people making the decisions that have actual kind of consequences for real people, for you, me, for your kids. You know, that, and yet the entire process of how that works is completely obscured. There's no transparency whatsoever in our system.
Probably the ironic thing is that you could actually get these names from the lists of sort of AGM documents and annual reports and sort of disclosures of, you know, tax disclosures. You could actually gather this information yourself. It's all done for you in conveniently in one book.
Yeah, I mean, all he's done is put it all in one place. Really, if you're looking for that book, by the way, it's called Scott Howard, Transgender Industrial Complex. All right, so let us carry on with this list. Okay, tell me to stop again. So we've got leaflets, pamphlets, books, newspapers and journals, records, radio and television, skywriting and earthwriting, deputations, mock awards, group lobbying, picketing, mock elections, displays of flags and symbolic colors. We've already seen that, especially in Ukraine. Wearing of symbols, prayer and worship, delivering symbolic objects, protest disrobings, destruction of own property. It's an interesting one, especially considering BLM. symbolic lights, displays of protest, painters' protest.
Stop. Do you remember that you do sometimes get people doing these projecting light slogans and also photographs on the side of buildings, especially public buildings? You know, like you know, when you've got sort of cause, and they do a projection on the Houses of Parliament, some or something, and of course they've got people already out there with cameras because they can only show them for about half an hour before someone comes to shut it off. But that's a good publicity stunt.
Displays of portraits, painters' protest. We've seen Extinction Rebellion use the paint extensively, haven't we?
And BLM.
On the paints and posters, because there was a I wouldn't call it a squat. It was there's a bit of a trend in London for like guardians, where people sort of live in abandoned spaces that can be redeveloped and they're waiting for planning permission.
Yeah,
and there was one where I was living near Walthamstow, which had been taken over by like an Extinction Rebellion cell, and it's just interesting to see them. That, I mean, they were like manufacturing through screen printing posters, flags on masse. But you know, all of the stuff that we're talking about requires a lot of graphic and artistic design, and again, all of that has to be organized, and the, you know, there's a quite a lot of expense to that, you know, again, and technical expertise as well that needs to be delivered. Like, consider each of these different elements requires money and expertise, or like the leaflet dropping, you're looking at like £300 for a whatever 150 double-sided color leaflets. You know, it's not cheap to produce this stuff, and that's where the money really comes in, I think.
Symbolic sounds, symbolic reclamations, rude gestures, haunting officials. Taunting officials. I mean, Unwashed is using some of these tactics. I happen to know Piers Corbyn and Unwashed have been, and various others have been, because they weren't getting media play with the mass protests. They've just been like turning up at like town hall meetings and things and being a pest, basically. So I know this is tactics that they're currently using. I wouldn't be surprised if Piers Corbyn has got this book and internalized it, you know, as a professional.
Yeah, this is a sort of guidebook for basically for leftist activists. But it's interesting that some of this could be used by, you know, people of different political persuasions.
Yeah, and I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that all, I don't think that Piers Corbyn and Unwashed are astroturfed in any single way. I'm just saying they're using these tech. Like, there's obviously, you know, legitimate or organic protest that takes place, and I don't see any evidence that like Piers Corbyn is being given like, you know, $90 million by the Ford Foundation, for example. But they're still using the same tactics. Fraternization, vigils. Oh, vigils. How many vigils have we seen?
Don't look back. Sarah Everard one.
Yeah, Sarah Everard. That was the biggest one. Let's carry on. Humorous skits and pranks. Performances of plays and music. Singing. Marches. Parades.
The performances just reminds me of, do you remember the cringe, like, Extinction Rebellion, where they had like a drama school and they were like, had like a broccoli or whatever, and they're all pointing at the broccoli or trying to arrest the broccoli.
Yeah, I remember. It's great. They're they are really the most.
Or you have die-ins where people pretend to be dead.
Yeah, the die-ins. Yeah. So there we go. Then we got religious processions, pilgrimages, motorcades.
So just on that, the religious processions, I wonder if that's where XR got a lot of their kind of red witches procession stuff from. There was a definite religious element put on it, you know what I'm saying? Like chanting and,
yeah, and the, circles. The anti, the pro-abortion stuff in America is increasingly, you know,
ritualistic,
ritualistic elements. When they all dress up as the handmaids. And there were quite a lot of religious overtones, if you remember, do you remember when the BLM thing started to get distinctly creepy with people like kneeling in front of black people and so on and so forth?
It was the police officer of a particular town or particular city, and he was washing the feet of black people as penance. So it was deliberately modeled on a religious act.
Yeah, I also remember there was the that mayor Jacob Frey. Do you remember that footage where he had to walk he bowed his head and he walked through the crowd and everybody shouted shame at him? That was incredible.
That was in Portland.
Really incredible. So then we let's carry on. Mock funerals, demonstrative funerals, homage at burial places, assemblies of protest or support, protest meetings, camouflage meetings of protest, teach-ins. That was a teach-in. What's a teach-in?
Teach-in is basically where you take over a university or a classroom and you have your own lessons. So this is what they used to do in the late 1960s, especially in America, to do with protesting the Vietnam War. That you would have a teach-in, so you'd have some sort of radical or sort of student spokesperson who would take over a lecture, and they would give a sort of a mock lecture on the iniquities of sort of the military industrial complex and so forth.
we're just living in one big teach-in right now, aren't we?
Yes, and that is now what official education at universities is.
Can you imagine we organise a protest and they was teaching, you know, in jumps academic agent, here's your quick free lesson on elite theory, folks. You know, what the fuck?
I'd love that. You'd ram it out with, you know, buy foundations of rhetoric.
Yeah, you'd be selling your course using crypto.
Walkouts, silence, renouncing honours, turning one's back. That also happened to Jacob Frey, where everybody turned their back on Jacob Frey. I remember that. What a cuck. Ostracism of persons, social boycott, selective social boycott, lysistratic non-action.
Oh, come on. As a literary scholar, you should know that. That's Lysistratus. That's where the women of Athens, they went on a sex strike. They said, end this war. If you don't end this war, they said, we will not have sex with you until you end this war.
I see. Okay. Fair enough. Excommunication, interdict.
Hold on. Let's get some excommunication going on. That's what we need to do.
I mean, they use these all the time, of course.
Yeah, it's interesting. They use excommunication in, like, I guess the proper sense, as in just to not speak to people. Did you see there was increasing articles about Democrats not forming relationships with Republicans? There's increasing stuff coming out about that, which I thought was very interesting. But
the T-shirt, never kissed a Tory. You've never seen those.
Yeah.
We should sell Never Kissed a Tory Boy.
And they're usually worn by the most unappealing types. And you think, oh, goodness, I dodged a bullet there. Not that I'm a Conservative voter, not a Conservative supporter.
Suspension of social and sports activities, boycott of social affairs, student strike. Now, of course, the most famous student protests ever were in 1968. Right. You know, one of the Marxist philosophers who was incredibly influential in that generation was Louis Althusser, you know, who was teaching in Paris at that time. And very interesting thing happened because he denounced the student protests as juvenile. And many of the kind of leading leftist thinkers of that era were not with the students. They just thought that they were being childish. And from their point of view, at that time, they thought that they were actually just helping the opposition. So as an example, the 1968 protests in America literally resulted in Richard Nixon, right? Mm. And in France, you'd have to have a look at exactly what happened in France. When was de Gaulle around? He was a little bit earlier, wasn't he?
He left in the early. It was the 1960s. That was the end of his career.
I have heard before that some of the leftist agitation in France were kind of elite. Machinations or leftist elite machinations to get rid of de Gaulle, who was a kind of, you know, curiously nationalist figure that was around in that time. But I think he'd gone by 68, I want to say, off the top of my head.
Just checking now. No, actually, there you are. In office 1959 to 1969. So he went in 69. So he did go the following year.
So there we go. Yeah, there we are. It was I think that was calculated to just oust him, basically.
But yeah, bad so it says, for him, yeah. So he said, re-elected to the presidency in 1965, he faced widespread protest by students and workers in May 1968. But he had the army support and won an election with an increased majority. So there you are. So this is definitely, so it wasn't a popular uprising. It was a niche uprising, as it were. But he resigned after losing the 1969 referendum, which he proposed decentralization.
Very interesting. Well, there we go. Even de Gaulle, undone by the centralizing nature of France, which never stopped centralizing. I mean, that's something that, let's say Zemmour wins, that's something that he'll have to deal with as well. I mean, it's going to take someone who's not just got heroic will, but kind of, you know, Napoleonic levels of heroic will to, or possibly even more than Napoleon, to deal with France at this point. I worry about the future of that country. Or not, as the case may be, because they're French. No, I joke. I do think
you'll start worrying about it when we start getting boatloads of native French people coming over because they're fleeing.
I think I might prefer boatloads of French people to even like most of our fellow countrymen at this point. I'm so disappointed in the average,
especially if they're based and well groomed.
Yeah, I mean, at the very least, a Frenchman will be like slightly more sexist than the average Brit. in all seriousness, they do have a little bit more of a nationalist edge about them in France. It's secular nationalism, but they have a stronger sense, I think, of national identity as a result of that than we do. Social disobedience, withdrawal from social institutions, stay at home, total person non-cooperation, flight of workers, sanctuary, collective disappearance. What the hell's that? It's collective disappear.
It's just basically where you stop. You stop going to work. You stop attending church. You stop going to social meetings. You just I think it's used sometimes in sort of South American situations where you can actually sort of go up into the jungle and you just sort of leave your place of residence.
That might not be a bad one for
So it's like Galt's Gulch, as it were.
Because I do wonder if everybody who was against lockdown and the thing just stopped working, just mass, if you were able to organise that, that might be effective, How you'd ever get out to work, I don't know. Protest emigration, consumers boycott. I've got a video forthcoming which will suggest that will never work in a million years at this point.
We know your story about the Procter & Gamble Gillette boycott. Yeah, it's just not practical.
I've been looking into numbers and it's just insane. Like Fairy Liquid, it's just guaranteed to sell like 22 million bottles a year. That's just Fairy Liquid. Who owns Fairy Liquid? Procter & Gamble. Pampers sales the same. I was looking at like Kellogg's Corn Flakes. 70% of the market, of the cereal market, is Kellogg's. 70% of the chocolate market is Cadbury's. So, like, how are you going to boycott these companies? Like, they're just not going to. Let's just say 5 million people boycotted Coca-Cola, for example. Will they really even notice? I honestly don't think they even notice.
So what you're doing is you're calling for a Teddy Roosevelt to come in and break them up.
I don't know what I'm calling for. I'm just saying that consumer boycotts are just not going to. I mean, again, just like the NGOs and these activists are part of the government, I'd encourage you to see all of these as part of the government. One of the things I've noticed is that there's 800 companies that have got this royal warrant on them. But this basically means they're permanent. It's just like there's no, I don't know, imagine people just stop buying. I don't know. How long do you think it would take for the mechanisms of supply and demand actually to result in the controllers of Sainsbury's, Tesco's, Aldi, Asda to, I don't know, take a Dairy Milk off the shelves? It's not going to happen. I just don't believe that supply and demand is a principle that affects major retail in on that level anymore.
But I think part of the problem is just the concentration that the supermarkets have over people, and again that the move away from local markets where you would literally go to your local area where people would bring local produce to these globalist temples. Basically,
Pharaoh is slipping in the carrot pill.
But that's how you genuinely protest something like this. It's not that you stop buying a product, it's you stop going to Sainsbury's itself.
Period, yeah. But, I mean, that's easier said than done, you know?
100%, really is easier said than done. Like, and again, I think that's an interesting... That in my mind is actually one of the bigger wins recently is, again, someone like Gab who have done that in a technical sense, creating... a totally independent network, but I mean that's only as good as your power. So, as you've got the power to back it up, really. So,
I mean, but I'll give you a real life example of how the supply and classical economics would say, well, if there's a demand shaped hole for Golden Wonder Crisps, say, okay, the public should be able to like will that into existence, right, and capital should reallocate in order to make Golden Wonder Crisps a thing. But Golden Wonder Crisps were just taken off the shelves in 2004. They sold 88 million pounds worth of crisps every year. Mm. Those crisps were not replaced. If you go to Sainsbury's now, it's just Walkers there. There is no Golden Wonder on the shelves in most places. I believe in some pockets of the north, you'll still find Golden Wonder Crisps. They're made by Tato, right? But the fact of the matter is that the market, quote, did not respond. It didn't respond because it's not even up to the consumers, what's on the shelves. There'll just be like a fat woman and working in Tesco's who's like, no, we've got a contract with Walkers for next number of years. No, what difference? We'll just sell our own crisps and Walkers, that'll do. You know, so that's it. That product's gone. It wasn't willed out of existence by the consumers. It was just, you know, a combination of mergers, mismanagement, etc. Or Woolworths. There was a Woolworths-shaped demand hole in the economy, right? They weren't, you know, plenty of people were going to Woolworths up until the moment they closed. They were closed due to toxic debt and mismanagement. Yet the market did not respond by creating a new Woolworths. Do you understand what I'm saying?
A good example of this top-down demand generation. Are you familiar with KFC in Japan at Christmas time?
No. What's that?
So basically, they've managed to create this Christmas tradition of eating KFC in Japan at Christmas. So obviously, right. You know, Japan, which has had no kind of like kind of Christian background. Just through sheer advertising, through influencers, and through pressuring, have created this idea that everyone has KFC on Christmas Day in Japan. Basically, it's a totally top-down, like no other country does this. It's just purely through advertising.
Oh, that's incredible! But it's a tradition, so it's baked in, though. Yeah.
But that's it. But it's just interesting. You can generate the demand through advertising. Advertising is a demand generator.
I want some company in India to say that every Christmas, every good Muslim and Hindu should buy an Alexander Adams book. That's what I need.
I mean, for that video, I got into it with one of the Tory boys who was saying, oh, listen, you're an academic. You don't understand how the world works. Everything you're saying is rubbish, blah, blah, blah. You know, so I just put the call out, you know, because when you've got an audience of 60,000 people, you know, there's a good chance that there'll be someone in the audience who worked in procurement. So I put the call out. So I've been in email contact with loads of people, and I've been asking lots of questions to make sure that I'm not talking complete rubbish in this. You know, that, you know, on top of the fact that I do actually understand how things work, I wanted to like hear it from the horse's mouth type thing. And one of the things we've talked about, Pharaoh, is the plant burgers, right? Now, anecdotally, from several different sources, I have heard that those plant burgers are very often left at the end of the day reduced to 10 pence.
I saw this in I was popped by Morrison's the other day. They had an entire section of own brand plant burgers, all massively on sale.
Yeah, because nobody's buying them, right?
Yes.
Yet, they're not bought for consumers. That has been sold into that has been an executive level decision to show that Morrison's have the right values, basically.
Yes,
it's a value signal.
They're meeting their ecological commitments.
Exactly, and they can show, well, we're carbon neutral now on paper. They can show that to the government. They can show that to lobby groups. We're doing our bit. It doesn't really matter if anybody buys them or not.
Yeah.
But also them just being there, people, that they will get enough traction if you can force it long enough. You know,
people are saying Austrian economy is dying. I'm just saying, like, you have to face up to how things work in the real world. And the reality is that I've done this, I kind of took some pictures of the shelves in Sainsbury's, and I've looked into, you know, a few different markets, and it feels like the structure in every market is the same. You know, you get a choice between the brand leader, Kellogg's, the number two brand, which I think is Weetabix, or could be Nestle in that market, right? It's often Nestle, I found, the second, you know, the number two brand, or, you know, Coca-Cola is the number one brand by some distance, by the way. Number two brand is Pepsi. And then the number three brand is the supermarket's own. That's it. That's every market. That's every product you can think of. You get number one brand, number two brand, supermarket zone. And I would say about half of those markets, it's literally number one brand is PG, number two brand is Unilever, and you know, you'll be lucky to get the supermarket zone in some of those market, in some of those kind of cosmetic aisles, you know. So Yeah, and the PNG is often disguised behind the fact that it's another brand there, you know, Fairy Liquid or Pampers or, you know, whatever else. Do they make Flash? Maybe they don't make Flash.
And a lot of the big manufacturers, they also do the own, they do the their own brand stuff, don't they?
Like it was found, for example, beyond doubt that Weetabix make the Weetabix for Tesco's as well. And for Asda, so because it makes sense, right? Because it's the same factory, so you know you literally aren't really getting a genuine choice.
Just an even deeper level, I don't know if you've considered. Think about new businesses and who gets startup capital and not. And again, it's just people who are networked with existing elites, basically. That's the number one reason to get startup funding. So
yeah, you could also draw an analogy between those brands and politics and political parties. You know, it's the contents are the same in each different packet.
A question though, Pharaoh. Let's pretend you wanted to get a new cereal onto the shelves of onto the shelves of Tesco's or Sainsbury's. What would it take to get the new like cornflakes on the market?
Yeah, that's a good question. FMCG is quite difficult. Fast moving consumer goods, which includes kind of like small, like one off purchases. I would say that you'd have to have an established brand with a certain amount of national sales to be even recognized by the buying team. Because obviously there's like a group of people at somewhere like Sainsbury's who are constantly looking for new products. And those kind of markets, there's not that much change very quickly, but there is around in like things like cereal bars. So what you would need to do is to create your brand, you'd have to own the manufacturing really, and then you'd have to kind of sell through smaller shops or direct until you've built up a big enough profile. And then you come in with like a monster deal where you're offering, like you're getting like no margin whatsoever just to get like be in Sainsbury's for the first time.
I see.
Yeah.
By the way, Procter & Gamble do make Flash. Just to let you know. It's remarkable. There's literally no brand that isn't owned by them. Let's carry on with this list. Refusal to rent withholding, policy of austerity, national consumers boycott, international consumers boycott, workmen's boycott, producers boycott, suppliers and handlers boycott, traders boycott, refusal to let or sell property, lockout, refusal of industrial assistance, merchants general strike, withdrawal of bank deposits, refusal to pay fees, dues and assessments, refusal to pay debts or interest, severance of funds and credit, revenue refusal of government's money, domestic embargo, blacklisting of traders, international sellers embargo, international buyers embargo, international trade embargo.
The blacklisting and stuff. Do genuinely think the future is basically creating our own black markets to avoid this, because this is going to happen to everyone. Do you know what I'm saying? There's going to be this moment where you can't shop at Sainsbury's. So you know where do you find your stuff? And it's going to be through an underground network of suppliers. So
protest strike, lightning strike, peasant strike, farm workers strike, refusal to impress labor, prisoner strike, craft strike, professional strike, establishment strike, industry strike, sympathetic strike, detail strike, bumper strike, slowdown strike, working to rules strike.
Can I just say they're really padding out the list here with these different strikes. Put strike once.
Reporting
sick, strike by resignation, limited strike, selective strike, generalized strike.
I suppose the reason they're listing them separately is because it might be effective if we target a specific kind of strike rather than calling an all-out general strike, which is kind of a blunt instrument. We can actually, you know, a particular government relies on us. It's like a banana republic. So if you're actually targeting like drivers who are driving bananas to the ships that are actually going to take the product overseas, if you target that crucial link with a strike. That might be more effective than trying to get everyone in the country to go on strike. So I guess they suppose they're specifying particular types that you could try.
Yeah. I'm very skeptical about the effectiveness of these. A lot of these recent ones have... you basically need to play into the fiction that all of these power centers are competing. Whereas I believe in 2021, almost every single one of these power centers have converged to the point where I think the globalists could just outmaneuver each one of these, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's possibly one of the reasons why they're so keen on the immigration, you know. Because, I mean, you know, you'll just be replaced with a pole tomorrow, you know, or you'll just be replaced. They don't care. Am I being ridiculously defeatist?
No, also, if you fracture the population along ethnic lines or religious lines or even sort of nationality status lines, what you do is you sort of prevent a lot of solidarity, a lot of group affiliation and so forth. So it automatically undermines groups from working in a concerted fashion.
I mean, the Robert Michel's point as well, in political parties, the iron law of oligarchy applies to trade unions. So trade unions will be on board with the establishment most of the time. You know, yeah. So if you get a trade union mandated strike, it will usually be with a view to, you know, some deal that is going to happen one way or the other. You know, let's take the standoff between the academics and the universities that goes on every once in a while, or the the Transport for London workers, you know, versus they just every once in a while they go on a strike and then they get, you know, a new settlement. That's just how it's worked for years. So there's a massive difference between those sorts of strikes and strikes that are designed to engender like actual change. I would suggest combination of strikes and economic closures, Hartl economic shutdown, withholding or withdrawal of allegiance, refusal of public support, literature and speeches advocating resistance, boycott of legislative bodies, boycott of elections, boycott of government employment and positions, boycott of government depth agencies and other bodies.
Stop. Yeah. Do you think boycott of elections would actually have any impact?
Well, I remember distinctly that Tony Blair had very low turnouts during his three election wins, and the system saw it as a sign that people were just content with a state of play, basically.
Yeah.
You know, it's just they interpret it as tacit consent, but this is another Schmittian question, right? Sovereign is he? It's not just who decides, but who interprets. Well, if your political formula, if your theology is the will of the people or something like that, well, somebody interprets the will of the people, and if you're Tony Blair, you're always going to interpret the will of the people as being something that you want. Yeah. As we've seen before, you know, and this is what rulers do most of the time. They're able to take any signal and transmute it into something they already wanted.
Although in some situations, legislatively speaking, that there are certain things that do not become law because they do not have a quorum, they do not have a sufficient sort of number of people participating.
Yeah, I mean, if the turnout was ridiculously low.
So I remember, like, the wasn't it the PR representation thing, the proportional representation vote. That we had to get a certain number of percentage of the electorate voting for that vote to count, and just people weren't interested and they didn't turn out for that vote on proportional representation. Yeah,
I seem to remember the Welsh Assembly one was borderline as well.
It was 49%, 51%, yeah. And it was also right on the cusp of being legitimate or not being legitimate as well.
Yeah, like just enough people voted basically to get it over the line. Withdrawal from government educational institutions, boycott of government supporting organizations. I mean, we're seeing the withdrawal from government educational institutions in America, which is a very, very interesting development.
Yeah. Homeschooling.
Boycott of government supported organizations, refusal of assistance to enforcement agents, removal of own signs and placemarks, refusal to accept appointed officials, refusal to dissolve existing institutions, reluctant and slow compliance. Welcome to the club. I'm doing that one. Non-obedience in absence of direct supervision. Popular non-obedience, disguised disobedience. Refusal of an assemblage meeting to disperse. Sit down. They love the sit down, don't they? The lefties.
So this is basically work to rule, where you're just basically doing the absolute bare minimum. You're not volunteering for overtime or anything like that. And you're kind of like deliberately sort of saying, well, you know, I don't understand how to do this. Could you show me how to do this? And just basically slowing everything down.
Non-cooperation with conscription and deportation, hiding, escape of false identities, civil disobedience of illegitimate laws.
Yeah, we've seen a lot of that from the left.
Selective refusal of assistance by government aid. Blocking of lines of command and information, stalling and obstruction, general administrative non-cooperation, judicial non-cooperation, deliberate inefficiency in selective non-cooperation by enforcement agents, mutiny. And it goes on and on and on. Bloody hell, there's so many of these. Shall we stop?
It's 198, so it only just covers it. It only just carries over to the next page.
All right. Quasi-legal evasions and delays, non-cooperation by constituent government unit, changes in diplomatic and other representations, delaying cancellation of diplomatic events, withholding of diplomatic recognition, severance of diplomatic relations, withdrawal from international organizations, refusal of membership in international bodies.
So that's sort of the upper echelons doing something against the rest of the establishment. So that's obviously not something that the man in the street could do.
Yeah, these are kind of Vladimir Putin level.
Yeah,
protests, yeah, I suppose. And then methods of non-violent information, self-exposure to the elements, the fast of moral pressure, hunger strike, satirographic fast. What's that?
Don't know.
Reverse trial, non-violent harassment, the sit-in. They love the sit-in as well.
Sit-in again.
I think that's when they will not leave somewhere.
Yeah.
I think the students did it a lot in university campuses in the 60s, didn't they? They do a sit-in protest. The stand-in, the ride-in, the wade-in, the mill-in.
By the way, there was a stand-in protest against lockdown. I don't know where it was. If you go to Carl Vernon's channel, he's brilliant. He does like these one-minute videos of sort of anti-lockdown stuff, and it's basically people doing a stand-in in somewhere in Europe, and they're standing and they're supposed to be 2 meters apart, and there's a policeman going between them with rods that are 2 meters long, and he's measuring the distance between the people who are standing in.
It's something like out of Brazil, or it's farcical almost. It's ridiculous.
I don't know what some of these are. The wading, the milling, the praying. Non-violent raids, non-violent air raids. What the hell's a non-violent air raid?
I'm going to do a non-violent air raid.
You can buzz them with drones or something, or you drop.
No, I'll give you an example of a non-violent air raid. It's okay to be white. Do you remember the plane?
Yes, that upset a lot of people, didn't it?
Non-violent invasion, non-violent interjection, non-violent obstruction, non-violent occupation, establishing new social patterns. Overloading of facilities, stalling, speaking, guerrilla theatre, alternative social institutions.
Well, that's Extinction Rebellion, isn't it? Guerrilla theatre.
I mean, we're trying to do the alternative social institutions. We've been trying to do that one. Alternative communication system, reverse strike, stay in strike, non-violent land seizure, defiance of blockades.
What's a reverse strike? You're just working even more.
Yeah, I don't know what a reverse strike is.
You thought we were going to strike, but we're going to work twice.
I don't know. But maybe it's where you work in a potato farm and you bury the potatoes. I don't know.
non-violent land seizure, defiance of blockade, politically motivated counterfeiting, preclusive purchasing, seizure of assets, dumping, selective patronage. I think the reverse strike is a mass sacking, isn't it? Because this is now, if assuming you've got control of the government, is it not? If it's economic intervention. Dumping, selective patronage, alternative markets, alternative transportation systems, alternative economic institutions, overloading of administrative systems, disclosing identities of secret agents, seeking imprisonment, civil disobedience of neutral laws, work on without collaboration, dual sovereignty and parallel government. Maybe
I think we should go for parallel government, to be honest. We just go straight for that.
Straight, yeah, parallel government.
Yeah.
I think there's an element of it happening in America where, you know, to a certain extent, Trump has set himself up as a kind of parallel president in a way, although it's been quite muted, I think, so far. But it is happening, kind of, where he issues his own statements on headed paper and, you know, he's still called president by everybody. And it's like he's still the Florida man is doing it to a certain extent as well. I'm not saying you should trust these people or anything, but, you know, it is happening as well.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else, or shall we hit the super chats?
I can't think of anything else.
That's it.
Yeah, there's the Piers. You sent me the Piers Corbyn story. Okay. All right. Years the Eunuch says, I got a good chuckle at my name drop on Cigar Stream last week, and you're right about my new work contract conflicting with your new stream schedule. I still listen to all the streams. I just can't participate in chat like I used to. Jacob says, do your recent Twitter musings on the duopolies and oligopolies of Procter & Gamble, Coca-Cola, etc., and the writings of Edward Bernays throw into doubt the Austrian assumptions regarding monopolies and consumer sovereignty? Have your opinions on the matter changed since your antitrust video? Well, if you remember your Austrian Economics 101, Rothbard does say that you cannot get these monopolies forming without state backing. And obviously, all of these corporations are creatures of the state. They're creatures of law, as we covered on a Cigar Stream recently. I would just say they are literally part of the state at this point. You know, there is no functional difference between the government and Coca-Cola, in my view. They're just an arm. They're just not another wing of the regime, essentially. That's how I'd see it. Does that change the laws of Austrian economics? No, but it does mean that the system that we're in is far less functionally capitalist than anybody would expect, I would suggest. Or it's much more top down. It's not, there is no, and I think if I had to get criticism of Austrian types and libertarians in general, is that they always make this move of pointing out crony capitalism, pointing out the corporations aren't real companies and so on. And then in the next breath, forgetting all of that and pointing and then trying to revert back to saying, oh, the consumer is sovereign over Coca-Cola. Well, it's either one or the other. So, I do think this is a weakness in, you know, this is a weakness in many people who, browse Mises.org one day and count the number of times when you'll find the libertarian unwittingly defending some massive corporation. It's like, well, you're not defending the market there, are you? You're literally defending the state. So I just think this is a little thing that is forgotten a lot by people. Have my opinions changed since the antitrust video? I would say that when it comes to these corporations, something, because they are creatures of the state in the first place, something would need to be done to deny them this status in the market. Because otherwise they'll just grow and grow until, well, the situation that we have now, where there is nowhere else to turn. Just make your own Procter & Gamble. Just make your own Tesco's. I mean, it's just folly at this point to think in that way, I would suggest. Jay Galt says, pro tip, go to www.ned.org regions and check in the projects they're funding in the country. NED is run by Trotskyites, and they engage in worldwide revolution LARPs through NED. Get rid of U.S. embassy if you want regime change. Yeah, I mean, it's my view that until the American empire falls, there's no hope for any of us, really. Because most of the activities that we're talking about are straightforwardly imperialist. It's just kind of an imperial power spreading its religion around the world. Its religion being the pause, basically. So there we go. User Eunuch says, I understand being vigilant, but calling everything organized and positive a Fed op is harmful. All LARPing is performative, but that doesn't mean it's always Fed or AstroTurfed. You talk about us needing to organize, but are critical and unsupportive of those of us who actually try. Come on, man. Pharaoh, do you want to come back on that?
Again, I wasn't even necessarily saying that Patriot Front was feds, but there was just a few suspicious things that I thought was interesting. I think my bigger concern is your group being co-opted for the system, and we sort of saw that with the kind of Gary Neville stuff that happened recently. We sort of and again the anti-vax gang, you know, it's very easy to be steered in a certain direction. So I think you have to be constantly on the lookout. You know, optics are important, and you know, goose stepping outside of the whatever Washington isn't the best look. You know, organized, but I would keep it subtle and secret.
I mean, my view on the lockdown stuff, as I've said before, is that if you make certain issues your only issue, the system will always find a way to contain that and redirect it. The biggest example I can think of is Brexit. Look how Brexit got completely contained and owned by the system in the end.
Yeah, because wasn't it Farage came out and said, oh, now we're separated from the EU. We can invite as many Indians and Commonwealth citizens as we want now.
Yeah, any kind of radical energy that event had was drained of it. You know, it was its potential for actual change was smothered. And I would say that the British ruling class throughout history have been absolute masters of that, which is why there are so few violent revolutions in the history of this country. They are the absolute masters of managing slow change, which is probably why the Tory party are the most successful political party in history. Terrible if you're a conservative or a reactionary or somebody who's on the right, but wonderful if you are part of the ruling class and want to stay in power. So let's carry on. Stray F says, $5 to demand a cigar stream one day on a text with actual optimism in it. AA needs to detox from cynicism. What do you mean cynicism, Stray F? I don't understand what you mean. What I provide is realism. And if you really understand the core tenets of what I've been talking about, you will see that there are avenues through which to be optimistic, but they have to be realist. They have to be real ones, you know, and realistically, you know, these protests that we've been talking about don't change anything. This whole stream, we've been talking about astroturfing and what is the purpose of these mass demonstrations. They're persuasion tools of people who already want to do these things, you know, 9 times out of 10. You know, I'm not saying that it's impossible, but you need like pretty tight organization. And I just don't think we're there yet. I just don't think we're close to having the constituent elements to create a successful counter elite that could genuinely enact change. I just don't believe it's there. One of the reasons for that is because there is no political formula to which everybody is willing to sign up to for a start. I mean, take the issue with Kat yesterday. People can't even agree on what the number one issue is, let alone
What you're talking about is it the
Kat appeared on Millennial and said that the right needs to stop fighting loot, like battles that have already been lost. She's talking about the demographic issue, and said that you need to focus, you know, most of your energies now on the pandemic, and that is the only issue as things stand. Well, not the only issue, but this is the number one thing that everybody should focus on, which caused a great problem. It caused a great outcry from many old school nationalists who were in Woz's crowd there. I mean, my view is that the only uniting factor that we all have is that we want to bring the regime down so that all energies are effectively negative, and that positive vision building comes after the fact of accruing power. That's how it's always happened historically. So you remove the power first and you come up with the political formula second. Otherwise, you're putting the cart before the horse. It's like you have to kill the Tsar first. Now you're in power. Now you say what you stand for. Does that make sense? It seems asked backwards, but I mean, that's always been the case.
Yeah, and I suppose once you've got a sort of an assertive, charismatic leader and a program that most people will back or most people feel is a good start, then you get like a critical mass and you can sort of consolidate from there, I suppose.
Yeah, but the slogan is not "I want this." The slogan is "Down with this."
Yeah.
And, you know, Mussolini stood in that square and he said, "I want to be the leader." That's it.
Yeah.
I will be in charge. And then once he was in power, he had to figure out what his political formula was. And it took him a few years to even figure that out, you know, and it became whatever it became. But I just don't, how can I put, I don't see any other unifying factor, you know, that everybody will agree on other than we want to remove the current elites. It seems overly negative, but I think you'll find that historically it's often been the case that the insurgent counter elite has literally just had the slogan "Down with this, down with all this, clear them out," and that should be the rallying call. What do you want to replace them with? Well, we'll deal with that once you're in power, basically. I mean, I could be completely wrong on this, but I suspect that it'll be impossible to mend divisions and create a unified enough movement otherwise, in my view, which won't get... You see, the thing is with "Down with them" is that that cannot be co-opted. It cannot be redirected. It cannot be made to be something else. It is always anti them, right? There's no, like, unless Gary Neville comes out and says, I want to overthrow the current elites. Right? He's not saying that. But Gary Neville is coming out and saying, "I don't like Boris Johnson." You know, I don't like the way he's doing this one thing over here. You know, but that can always be co-opted. All right.
Well, that's the position of 90% of the establishment.
Yeah. Exactly. That is literally the mainstream view, which is why Gary Neville
and all the civil service and all the mass media.
But I mean, let's pretend you make the pandemic and the vaccines your only issue. Well, what happens when the regime just says, "Okay, then we're not going to do it"? Victory. But it's not, though. They're still in charge. They'll move to some other fucking thing. It'll be climate change next, or it'll be, you know, they'll do some other trick.
Social credit system.
Whatever it happens to be. So the problem is not the pandemic. It's downstream. The problem is the current elites that are in power. Am I wrong?
No. I think that's correct assessment. I think what you need to do is you do need to try and take away certain causes as a tool, as a proximate reason for the establishment being able to do X or Y. But yeah, that's not going to solve the problem. That will just postpone it or move it to a different area.
Ian Inkster says, The thing is, they can. The thing is, Down With Them can't be made into some other thing that they can then flip around on you. Do you understand what I'm saying? Like, there's no way that they could do a Brexit on that.
Except of course, if you make it so that Down With The Aristocracy, and then suddenly you start defining the aristocracy as anyone who's got an average income of over, you know, whatever. You could be a little bit slippery, which is what, you know, which is what happened with Pol Pot in Cambodia. It's just like, down with the colonial imperialists, and oh, by the way, and all school teachers, and then everyone who wears glasses. And it was literally executing everyone who wore glasses.
Yeah. Well, that's not a bad rule of thumb. Ian, I'm only joking. Ian Ingster says, okay, create how to spot meme. Action follows talk. Glow in the Dark says, highest form of AstroTurf movements is the one that has years of propaganda to push the narrative and an indoctrinated generation that will answer the call from the puppet masters to protect subconsciously. Yeah, I mean, they've been working on the Extinction Rebellion one for many years. I mean, when I was in school, it was all ozone layer and the rainforest and things like that. But it was still the same message, really. You know, the environmental green stuff. And then in the 90s, it was global warming, and now it's climate change. Wanahee says, I mean, have you seen the amount of people saying that climate change is causing footballers to collapse? I mean, that's an interesting one. Wanahee says, schools and universities have trained our rulers to be ruled and our rule to be rulers. The doctrine of mass and its consequence are a disaster. Yes, especially given that it's always a lie. Always a lie. That's the number one lesson of the Moscow and Friends, that, you know, the democracy is and only can be a sham. That's the biggest thing. It's literally structurally impossible for it not to be a sham. You will never have a situation where the ruled actually are sovereign. Impossible. Just practically impossible. You know, let alone any other considerations. It just cannot be done. Ludic Parth says, ever consider doing a series on George Soros and his theories on finance and reflexivity? No. Although I do have a George Soros book here called... or somewhere on one of my shelves called the American Bubble. Maybe it could be interesting to do that, but I fear that Soros is heavily algoed. I mean, how many Soros videos are there out there? Let's have a look.
And I deliberately just didn't say that word earlier, and now I've made myself look foolish.
Well, I mean, I think you're allowed to say his name.
well, I'm not sure.
Number one video. Who is George Soros? BBC News. Million views. Gravitas Plus. Does George Soros manipulate the global order? I wonder what they say. The billionaire at the heart of a global conspiracy theory, BBC Stories.
Ah, conspiracy theory. Therefore, they don't have to think about it. Yeah.
George Soros, the future of Europe, just a speech by him. So I'm not seeing a lot of non-blue check marks talking about this, to be honest. So there we go. I mean, yeah, I don't see any big accounts which have videos about George Soros. Like big non-mainstream accounts, I mean. Yeah, that was it. The bubble of American supremacy. I mean, maybe he's an ally. He wants the same thing as me, to bring down the American empire, but I doubt so. Okay, let's carry on. Stray F says, optimism in the sense of a positive vision of the human condition. Earlier Carlyle, Frederick the Great, not anti-realistic realism, insufficient. I honestly think that positive vision is a cause of division, and that the vision can only be negative before you get to power, and then you have to have some sort of formula afterwards. Karen Took the Kids says, as Vox Day says, one thing you could always be certain of is the official narrative is always false. Correct. That's my number one faith position. That's my political formula. Media always lies. Always. Years the Eunuch says, I understand being... Oh, we did that one. Okay. And that's it. Does anybody have...
got one final one.
AA, how old are you? Well, mind your own business, Chris. How old are you?
He says, how are you?
Oh, sorry. I misread that. I'm all right. Getting hungry. Tetchy. Bugger off. Pharaoh, do you have anything to chill, sir?
If you go to my channel, check out the stream Alexander Adams' Panama Hat and I did on fashion and politics. And I'm very much looking forward to part two of the Christmas ads next week.
Oh, yes, the Christmas ads. I did see Dee saying that he's burst out laughing every time he's seen the thumbnail. It's made me laugh every time I've seen it.
Literally,
as well.
So funny.
The diversity bubble.
I did laugh and wince at the same time while I was listening to it live.
Alexander Adams, do you have anything you'd like to shill, sir?
Yes. If anyone wants to support my work, they can buy copies of my books, Iconoclasm and Culture War, which are available on bookselling websites. There will be four new books out next year. So keep an eye open for those. I imagine I'll be appearing somewhere that you'll hear about it. If you want to read more of my writing and find out other ways of supporting me, you can go to alexanderadamsart.wordpress.com. And since I'm not going to be appearing on any more streams until January, I'd like to wish everyone a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Oh, and you too, Alexander Adams.
Thank you.
I should note, Chris, I feel guilty for being, for lashing out at you. Thanks for the super chat. It means so much. I will just mention courses are available, of course. Get the Trivium before Christmas. Get Foundations of Research, especially all of you who says, you mentioned this book, where is it? You should be able to instantly find anything in the world. Foundations of Research, Foundations of Economics. But the big one, Foundations of Politics, is getting there slowly but surely. Each of these lectures is about 4,500 words so far. So, it's been taking quite a while. The bulk of secondary literature on Schmitt is quite huge. I wasn't aware that quite so many people had written on him. And that's a story in itself, by the way. I haven't been able to put that in the lecture, but the way the left basically co-opted a Nazi jurist as one of their premier thinkers in the 1990s is quite something to behold. I've never seen anything like it. To the extent where individual journals flip from being like left wing to kind of calling themselves beyond right and left and things like that, which is, I've never seen anything like that before within academia. Given that this guy literally was a Nazi. All right, everybody. Most importantly of all, get out.